Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 28th of November. Last year, we did a program on drug shortages. As you'll recall, there were a number of drug shortages in the year 2011. And this year, there are still drug shortages, although the situation is not as dire. Our guest this hour is going to be taking on two issues for us. One, how extensive is the drug shortage and what's the reason for it and what are the answers to it? We'll also be talking about a recent New York Times article that looked at young boys, particularly middle school boys, who really want this kind of tough, muscular body image, and they're going to gyms. They're also going into obsession and using rather expensive supplements to get this body image that they think is a good one. And there are some in the medical community who are saying that the use of these supplements could be dangerous to their health. Our guest this hour actually happens to have expertise in both of those areas, so we'll talk about both. Professor Amy Peek is Associate Professor of Pharmacy Practice at the College of Pharmacy Health Science at Butler University. Her special areas of expertise include drug medical information and also herbal products and dietary supplement. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Amy Peek during the course of this hour. To reach us, as always, it's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. You can always send a message to us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show, or tweet us at K Dunn Show. Professor Amy Peek, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
I remember doing a program on this last year where there was really a pretty substantial shortage of cancer drugs, particularly. What is the overall situation right now? Is it fair to say it still exists, but it's not as bad?
I think that is true. Currently, right now, I was looking this morning, and there appear to be 119 drugs available in short supply right now. So if you think about that, that's still 119 drugs, so that's a lot. But around this time previously, there was more like 250. So we are moving in the right direction, but there's still room for improvement for sure.
And what kinds of drugs are they?
Mostly they are injectable drugs. So our friends in the hospital pharmacies, in outpatient surgery centers, places like that are really feeling the shortages more so than, say, in community pharmacies and people who are taking predominantly oral medications. Those supplies seem to be much more stable than many of the agents that are injectable products right now.
And last year, I recall, there were a number of cancer drugs, chemotherapy drugs, that were in short supply. Is that still the case, Amy?
There are some, but many of them are easing a little bit. Right now, we actually seem to have bigger challenges in the area of anesthesia and surgeries. So luckily, there are lots of drugs in those classes, but maybe the agents that our anesthesiology friends and other people are most used to doing and are most comfortable with and maybe would be their first choice might not be available right now. So we're working closely to make sure that surgeries aren't canceled and those types of things. So I think anesthesia is a challenge right now, as are our medications sometimes for nausea and vomiting, which go along with surgeries as well. So those are two areas where we're having some trouble. And some of our injectable pain medications, for example, morphine is in short supply right now. One of the biggest problems with that is what we can still get morphine, but we can get it in really concentrated forms. So when we're used to purchasing it, maybe in a 2 milligram or a 4 milligram or an 8 milligram dose, we're having trouble getting those normal doses. We can just get these really high doses, like 25 or 50 milligrams. So we have this big safety concern that it would be much easier to overdose a person because the concentration of the drug that's on hand is many times that of what we would normally be using. So it isn't just a supply. There really is can then be a safety issue that puts us at risk for medication
error. I would imagine. So with the reasons for a shortage of anesthesia drugs and for morphine for pain medication be the same, or there are a whole different set of reasons?
There's a different set of reasons for every medication available. I could give an example with propofol. This is an agent that is also used in the surgery setting. One of the reasons for that shortage had to do with the storm, with Hurricane Sandy.
Oh, really?
So one of the suppliers and manufacturing areas could be damaged. So people don't think about natural disasters being a contributing factor, but they certainly can be, both in the United States as well as in other countries. So also it's interesting with that particular product, the FDA has worked with manufacturers outside of the United States and has been able to help acquire the same drug, but just a European drug, and allow that to come to the U.S. market. So there's trying to be some creative ways to help maintain the supply, even if a U.S. manufacturer isn't the person mm-hmm. that's continuing to do it.
What about this story that was a big story, and it's not as front and center right now, is the compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts that supplies drugs to hospitals and to doctors. There was contamination of the facility found. It affected people with certain kinds of diseases. Has that been cleared up, or is that still problematic?
That is problematic, and those facilities are closed. So that actually is also contributing to new shortages, that sometimes the products that they were producing were things that a traditional manufacturer wasn't able to supply. So they were compounding them. And so when that was our fix to problem A, now problem B might have been a much greater problem in the first place. So I think that the whole situation should cause us to take a step back and pause for a minute and say, you know, maybe having a drug in short supply that isn't a life-saving medication, maybe that's a better option than having something in our supply chain that could potentially be harmful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of people initially with the drug shortages were saying that the FDA was being too strict with some of the manufacturing facilities, and that was why we're seeing these shortages. And I would like to put out there, you know, maybe we want the FDA to be strict in terms of making sure that the products are truly manufactured in a safe and sterile environment. So I think that the FDA is doing the best they can with what they have to work with right now.
Are the examinations of those facilities pretty rigorous?
The examinations of facilities that are regulated as pharmaceutical manufacturers, like the Pfizers, the Mercks, the Eli Lilly's and Company of the world, those are very rigorous. They are not very rigorous in a facility that is licensed as a compounding pharmacy. And I think many people would argue that although the facilities that have recently been associated with the meningitis outbreak and the fungal contamination, that though those facilities were licensed as compounding pharmacies, they likely were in fact operating as manufacturers and should have been regulated in a different fashion.
And why weren't they?
Usually, a compounding pharmacy works in a fashion that is, they get an individual script from a particular physician for a specific patient, and they manufacture it. They make that compound right then and give it to the patient. So the concept of there being thousands upon thousands of doses of these many drugs being shipped to facilities all over the country, that's pretty outside of what a typical compounding pharmacy's operating structure is. And so I think a lot of people would argue, you know, I think that those facilities maybe were operating outside the scope of a compounding pharmacy and more as a pharmaceutical manufacturer, and probably there should be more clear distinction at when you would cross that line between serving an individual's patient needs and doing this larger scale production.
News reports are indicating that healthcare facilities may be using expired drugs or less effective alternatives. Let's take on the expired drugs. Do drugs become quite ineffective after an expiration date, or are they pretty good for a long time after that date?
It truly depends on the individual product and why that expiration date was assigned. For example, I used to work in a facility, and one of the product's expiration date was given because that is as long as they could guarantee the glue on the label would stick to the bottle that would have the information about the product on it.
Really?
So that particular drug was literally stable for years and years and years, but we had like a 3-year expiration on it because we couldn't guarantee the integrity of the glue that stuck to the label for that long. So that's an extreme example. But there are many products that their expiration date might not have anything to do with the actual drug product inside of it. It might have something to do with the way the seal could be maintained on the top of the product, or the conditions under which it's stored, etc. So in general, I wouldn't recommend using things past their expiration date, but this isn't, you know, a normal time. So we do know that there are certain products that either do become less effective or that could be problematic. So, for example, I would never recommend using sublingual nitroglycerin that has expired, because we know that long-term that product isn't going to be as effective. And if someone's carrying sublingual nitroglycerin and they need it, they really need it. Whereas if you're taking maybe a dose of Tylenol that's 6 months old, if that is a little bit less potent, maybe that's not a horrible thing. So it's unlikely to cause you harm, but most drugs, there isn't, unfortunately, a good generalization that we could say, oh, yes, these drugs are good forever or for X amount of time. But expiration dates could be due to all kinds of things, not just the actual stability of the drug inside.
Oh, that's interesting. What has happened to decrease the number of drugs that are in short supply? What has industry done? What has government done to make that a shorter list?
Well, one of the things now, there's better communication when a pharmaceutical manufacturer is choosing to make a business decision not to produce a product anymore. So let's say there is a generically available product and there are 6 manufacturers. If a manufacturer is choosing that, you know, this business decision, this product isn't profitable for me, I'm not going to make it anymore, they then notify the FDA a minimum of 6 months in advance. So that now gives time to other manufacturers of the product to increase their production to meet what they know is going to be a larger demand, since one of the people in the marketplace is leaving. So that can help, and better communication, even when it's not a permanent discontinuation, if they know that they're having trouble getting some of the raw materials to actually make the drug product. That is one of the common reasons for shortages, so better communications and learning through those items. And I think one of the contributing factors as well is, what do we normally stock as a typical inventory, both in the pharmacies and in the warehouse? So, you know, in this economy especially, most people choose to keep an inventory that is just a few days worth of stock because they get shipments up to 6 days a week. So if you get shipments 5 or 6 days a week, there really isn't a need to have, you know, stockpiles of medication. So part of it is understanding, when we first see a drug that begins in short supply, how do we also then stock what I'm calling the domino effect? So if we can't use drug A, what's the logical alternative or alternatives to use, and then how do we stock those products as well? So I think we're getting better at inventory management.
We're going to welcome phone calls. There's also another part to our conversation this morning, which we'll get to down the road here, because our guest is an expert in this area as well. I don't know if you saw the New York Times piece last week that looked at young boys, middle school boys, who are concerned about body image, and they're going to gyms to work out, but they are also using very expensive supplements. We will talk about what those supplements are and if indeed they could be dangerous, and why this obsession with a muscular kind of body image. How extensive is the problem? We'll move into that as we move along here. Our number is 800-486-8655. Amy Peake is our guest, Associate Professor of Pharmacy Practice at the College of Pharmacy and Health Science at Butler University. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, November's edition of the Back to School Book Club, will be looking at Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. So that's today after 10 o'clock. We will speak, of course, with Russ Castronovo, professor of English and American Studies at UW-Madison. And also Ivy Wilson will join us, associate professor of English and director of American Studies at Northwestern University. To your phone calls for Amy, let's start with Sam in Madison. Hi, Sam.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Amy. Amy, I'd like you to address two possible reasons for drug shortage. The very first one is the overprescription of drugs by doctors. I feel that in the U.S. especially, I think the doctors overprescribe a lot of drugs, even when the patients don't need it, and there is documented evidence for it. And so I'm wondering if that contributes to the drug shortage. The second reason I'd like to address is the supply, the manipulation of the drug supply by the drug companies themselves. I mean, maybe I'm being a little bit skeptical, but I feel like sometimes drug companies can also keep the demand low or supply low so that the demand is high and they can actually charge more for the drugs. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you,
Sam, for the call. Professor Peake.
Sure, those are both great comments. The first issue of potential overprescribing, I think that definitely depends on the agents involved. So some of these agents, I truly don't believe that that's an issue. But there are other agents, for example, when agents like Ritalin and Adderall were in significant short supply, and those agents being controlled substances, the only types of agents that there are government limitations on how much of that drug product can be made in a certain time frame, and those are based on what normal usage has been historically for those agents. So I do think, on one hand, there is some overprescribing of agents, especially in that category. And along with that, I think of diversion of agents in that category. So abuse of those types of agents, and whether that's abuse from the standpoint of being prescribed inappropriately or abuse from the standpoint of people stealing or taking drugs or using them for non-medical purposes. Being on a college campus, I unfortunately see that all the time with the Adderall and Ritalin type agents. So I think for certain agents, that certainly can be a legitimate contributing factor.
And why are students taking that? They feel it makes them concentrate better, or...?
They do. And if you ask students why they use Ritalin or Adderall for non-medical purposes, virtually all of them, their response is related to academic performance, studying, increased study ability, and very, very little are from the aspect of getting high or something like that from what you would see from diversion of a product like hydrocodone or oxycodone, which is common. But I think that on a college campus in particular, it's really alarming the number of people who misuse Ritalin and Adderall type products. Very scary.
Mm-hmm. We go to Mike next in Racine. Hello, Mike.
Hi. You know, I wanted to respond to the discussion you had early on about maybe some of the other causes of shortages, and that's around product expiry, product stability, shelf life, things of that nature. You know, I've worked my entire career in FDA-regulated industries. First 17 years of that was in the pharmaceutical analysis space, where we actually did the studies and established expiry dates on pharmaceutical products.
Oh.
And the concern that I had when I heard that discussion was that chemical stability is one of the important components of product shelf life. But these other factors that were brought up, such as labels falling off, the integrity of the seals, what the conditions of storage are, and so forth. The problem with talking about that in a forum like this is that a person can take the impression is that, well, you know, that doesn't seem right. You know, we can still use the product if the label falls off, or if the seal's compromised, but the chemical stability is okay, how do we know? Well, when we do this stability testing, there are a lot of assumptions that we put into those studies, and they have to be controlled. And the bottom line is that unless you have an extremely detailed knowledge of that specific product and its chemical makeup, its physical makeup, because physical parameters affect stability as much as the chemical parameters, you really can't make a decision. A practitioner does not have, you know, a doctor or a pharmacist typically doesn't have the knowledge and information available to them and all their references to be able to make an educated determination that that product is still good if the label falls off because they don't know what the product is, although a physician can use their desk reference, but a patient can't. If the seals are compromised, if the storage conditions were not maintained, a practitioner or a pharmacist typically doesn't have the information that the manufacturer has when they did the initial stability studies to make a good decision. So the only safe course of action in all of those actions is to assume that that shelf life is what it is, as labeled on the product. And we shouldn't even be really talking about these alternatives because it puts into the mind that we're somehow, you know, I don't know, what I took away when I heard the discussion is that, well, so what if the label falls off? Well, if you're an elderly patient and it's got three pink pills, all generally of the same shape, and the label falls off of their thing, how are they going to determine which is the one that they're supposed to take once a day versus the one they're supposed to take 4 days?
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. I think the discussion came, Mike, from the indication that there are healthcare facilities because of the shortage of drugs that are using expired drugs.
And they're playing with fire if they do that.
I don't mean
regulatory fire. I mean safety fire.
I will make a comment, though, that is certainly not the norm, and it's not something we recommend. And to my knowledge, when places do that, that is with additional information from either the manufacturer or the FDA that would indicate that there would be a reason to think that drug product is something that is still safe to use beyond the expiration date. So I fully agree with the caller that there is very legitimate safety concerns about using a product beyond the expiration date, and that there is nothing that I would have at my fingertips typically that would tell me that would be safe unless I get that information directly from that particular product's manufacturer or the FDA. Mm-hmm. And we've actually seen that in the last year or two in isolated cases where one or two of those, either the manufacturer or the FDA, has provided documentation that could be a reasonable alternative in dire situations.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely not something I would recommend doing normally, but it's a very odd situation in which someone above the individual practitioner gives a legitimate reason to think that would be an acceptable practice.
Thank you very much for your informative call, Mike. We have lines open for you right now. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're talking about drug shortages, and let's move so we can broaden the conversation a little bit to this other story, which appeared last week, that a number of young boys in middle school are using expensive supplements, and many have experimented with steroids, but let's concentrate on those supplements in order to build what they feel is a good muscular body image. I know you're an expert in supplements as well. Can you talk about the kinds of supplements that are being used, Professor Peake, and how they may pose a danger to these young lads?
Sure. There's a variety of types of supplements being used, and there's ones that I think have probably low risk and some that are much higher risk. So, for example, especially in the bodybuilding community, there's a lot of information and misinformation about the role of supplements that are testosterone-based or maybe derivatives of testosterone. There are some products that are just basically meant to be a protein powder or a supplement that provides a protein source, usually derived from a dairy-type product, so a whey protein. Then there's other products or supplements like creatine and things like that. So there's actually decent scientific data that indicates that if you consume significant amounts of protein after you have done some type of physical activity requiring muscle resistance, so things like lifting, et cetera, that if you eat a certain amount of protein compared to the exact same number of calories consumed as carbohydrates, people who consume the protein have a larger muscle mass after using those muscles. So it's not this magic situation where if I take this supplement, my muscles are magically going to grow. But there is some science based on the food you consume within maybe an hour or so of true significant challenging resistance training. So that type of product I'm less concerned about than the types of products that are being marketed as steroid precursors or products like creatine, which really probably aren't the best types of supplements for anyone unless maybe you're a professional linebacker that's doing nothing but trying to gain bulk and, you know, have no cardiovascular need. But so it's really concerning. You know, I do think that it's not surprising in the big picture that middle school is a time where boys and girls become incredibly self-conscious. And it seems interesting that girls have been doing these types of things for years, just maybe not in terms of muscle supplements, but in terms of weight loss or other things related to self-image. So there's lots of interesting twists to the story.
And what exactly is creatine?
Creatine is a supplement that is often promoted to increase muscle mass. And if you really look at the studies from this product, it does not appear to do anything to do things like increase any type of aerobic activity-based product. It doesn't make you run faster. It doesn't help you from athletic components in that fashion. So what a lot of people, a lot of manufacturers promote it as a product that is meant to help someone bulk up. And if you look both scientifically at the product and the data that's available, there isn't a lot of good data or solid science to support that that would be either a very safe or effective method of increasing muscle mass. And I think what concerns me the most are the products that are promoted as being some type of along the line of steroids, steroid precursors or steroids themselves. And one thing I will put out there is that, you know, testosterone as a product that it is not effective if taken orally. So if you look at any of the prescription testosterone products, none of those go through the GI tract. If you take it through the GI tract, it is broken down, it's ineffective, it's not absorbed. So a lot of these testosterone products, if they are testosterone themselves and it's an oral supplement, it's really not going to work, period. It just isn't, and not to mention that's a controlled substance in the United States. So if they're taking a product that is truly a testosterone product, how they're getting that and what that product truly consists of can be challenging and scary.
And what kind of regulation is there on some of those that are not controlled substances? Is there a good oversight of this industry? Because I would imagine it's pretty huge if this need to have a muscular body is so great that people are cashing in on it.
This industry is huge.
Is it?
And it is very, and because it's just starting earlier, several years ago, this industry was catering mainly to people in their 20s to 40s who were bodybuilders. And now this is the whole industry is broadening not only to younger people but to older people, and not just people who are hardcore bodybuilders, but to all types of men and women with the concept of increased muscle mass, decreased fat mass. So, and, you know, theory and concept, that sounds, wow, that'd be great if this product could really do that. But things that sound too good to be true usually are. And there's very little regulation in terms of the manufacturing of these products. So there truly is challenging, and studies have shown that not everything that's in those products are always listed on the label. Sometimes they're contaminated with other things. Sometimes there's products purposefully put in there that are not included on the label. And many products could simply be a waste of money. There might not be what it claims to have in them actually in them. So there is both a legitimate safety risk as well as a financial risk. None of these products are very cheap. So you know, some of them, you're really just washing your money down the drain.
Why is it so hard for us to learn, Amy, that some of it is just common sense? You should eat well. We know what we should eat. You need to exercise. You need to not smoke. And you need to have a lot of friends.
And, absolutely.
And so why is it that's so hard to adhere to? Why do we feel that we need to have a certain kind of body? Why is this such a difficult issue for girls and boys?
If I had the answer to that, I'd be a rich woman. I really don't know. But I think I think part of that realization comes with maturity.
Mm-hmm.
That when you're a younger person, especially middle school, high school, college, and also those are very formative years for your lifelong self-image and self-esteem, that I think you believe what other people tell you. You believe the commercials. You believe the magazine ads. You believe what your friends say. And I think once you're later into adulthood, you have a maturity on your side a little bit and can understand, you know, that's marketing, that's advertising, that's what other societal pressures were, but that's not reality.
Let's go to Porter in Madison, our next caller. Our number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. Hi, Porter.
Hi. I'd like to comment on the staggering price difference of the compounding pharmacies. I need three drugs that used to cost me a total of $30 a month, and now they're $150
Ooh,
a month.
Oh, my.
And I'm semi-disabled. I lived on a very restrictive budget. That $120 comes out of my food budget.
And what
I have to have those drugs.
What are the drugs for, Porter?
Arthritis and depression.
Mm-hmm. Professor?
Unfortunately, I think that's the law of supply and demand. And in our country, unfortunately, healthcare is a for-profit industry. And I absolutely agree that this is sad, and I wish I could change that. I don't have good answers, but we don't really have any type of price control regulations in the United States. Certainly, other countries do, and those types of things might not be able to happen there. But just as one of the previous callers says, you know, manipulation somewhat by the drugs companies themselves allow them to set the pricing structures. If one product isn't available, and it was available by three manufacturers, and now it's only available through one, that one manufacturer can pretty much charge whatever they want because there's not options anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a sad, unfortunate reality that I don't have a good answer to be able to change that.
It is one of those industries that seems to be almost sacrosanct, doesn't it? I recall doing a program years and years ago in which the guest, who had a good understanding of the pharmaceutical industry, said that the industry really hasn't been very carefully examined since the 1950s. I mean, what Porter is going through is not right. She shouldn't have to not eat in order to pay for the drugs that she needs.
Mm-hmm. I fully agree. We do not, in our current healthcare system, you know, there just simply isn't a mechanism that anything is illegal in terms of setting the price of the drugs that they have. So in a free market society, they're going to set it at what they think people will pay for it. And that's a huge challenge. And day-to-day, regardless of compounding pharmacies or drug shortages, one of the things I do is I volunteer at a clinic that only serves people who do not have insurance. And a huge part of what I do is try to work with prescribers to say, okay, we have these three disease states, and what medications are low-cost generic options that we could use so these patients don't have to choose between spending their money on food or gas or rent or drugs. And, you know, all of those things are essential.
We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We are looking at a couple issues in the drug-related industry today. One we just moved into, if you'd like to talk at all about the use of supplements. Now we find out that middle school boys are going to the gym in large numbers, but they're also using expensive supplements to get this muscular body image. And many have experimented with steroids, why that's a problem and what can be done about that and why this muscular body image is so important. We're also doing an update on a story last year and looking at where things are now in terms of shortages of drugs in this country. It's not as extensive, the list, as it was last year, but there are still a number of drugs that are in short supply, the reasons for that and what needs to be done to keep that from happening. Here's our phone number for you to join this conversation, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. Leave messages for us also on our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our two of our program today, it's our Back to School Book Club, and today the selection is Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, an American Slave. It's quite a story. It's hard to read some of this, but it's a very, very important book in American history. The Narrative was an overnight bestseller. It was written in 1845, and it also became an international big seller as well, with 30,000 copies in Europe and in America. It was published in French and in German. It's an autobiography that one person has said is an autobiography as a writer's life as well, the life of the imagination of the slave. So that's hour two of our program. Back to phone calls. Jess in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hello, Jess.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I just want people to not be confused by supplements and steroids, because steroids are not supplements to be used to develop a body or whatever. But what most people don't understand is that we are facing nutritional deficiencies across the country. As an example, vitamin D is almost epidemic in its shortfall of people receiving enough vitamin D in their diets and or from the sun. You can Google this to find out more information about a vitamin D deficiency, and that's where a lot of people are taking vitamin supplements to make up for what they're lacking, either in our food supply or wherever else they get their sources from.
Professor Peek.
I fully agree with that. I just think that's a slightly separate issue than the types of supplements that middle school boys are using for athletic enhancement. So I fully agree that there is a substantial issue with this paradox even of extreme obesity in the United States and significant malnutrition, meaning that people eat a ton but not of the right things. And whether that's with vitamin D, which is a substantial deficiency in the United States, or whether that's other types of even good protein or calcium or other things. But supplementing vitamins and minerals is very different than supplementing the types of products that are being promoted to people who for athletic enhancement.
Those middle school boys aren't running out after they work out at the gym to get a vitamin D tablet.
They are not.
Yeah.
And I will comment, though, that there is a lot of information out there and supplements that are promoted for athletic use that have really huge amounts of B vitamins in them, and saying that you need vitamin B for energy. And while that's true, the amount that are in those are so excessive and unnecessary. So most people, if they use those supplements, they will notice that their urine is slightly more yellow to orange than what it is previously, and that's your body just flushing all those extra B vitamins that you're taking out because it doesn't need them to use them. So it's smart enough to know that, hey, I'm getting enough, so some is great, but anything I don't need, I'm going to be flushing out of you. So that's one of the things that I talk about with people. Do we need vitamins and minerals? Absolutely. If we can get them from our diet, great. If we can't get them from our diet, that's when we use supplements. And there really isn't a need to use these mega supplements because our body is going to either flush them out or store them for long term if they're not a water-soluble product. So,
thanks, Jess, for the call. Mark in Bayside. Hi.
Hi. I'm a retired physician, and one of the ironies of treating people with brand-name drugs is the companies often offer coupons for people to reduce the price of the drugs. But unfortunately, people on Medicare, Medicaid, and other government programs are not eligible to receive these because of the federal laws. So really, that's the people who need them the most often or usually can't get them.
Amy?
I fully agree that I think that both the practice of sampling and some of the coupon programs are very challenging and oftentimes actually increased healthcare costs, not decreased costs, because if there is a similar product that's available generically, sometimes even in the $4 a month range, some people would suggest that even if you're giving a product that's a coupon or a sample of a competitor's product that's substantially more expensive, in the long run, even if you get 3 months for free of a product that is very expensive, the rest of the 9 months of the year, using an alternative product every day of the year that was less expensive to begin with is going to be more cost effective. The challenge is that doesn't happen, obviously, for every type of drug. There's not always an equally effective, less expensive option. But the drug companies are incredibly effective using both those coupons as well as samples in terms of altering market share to products that aren't always the latest and greatest. Doesn't always mean they're the most effective or safest product.
What's the answer, Mark?
I wish I knew. You know, if they reduce the cost of the drug, they would. You know, what they're giving out in the coupons is really a very small amount, I think, compared to what they're charging for the drug. And obviously, if they reduce the cost of the drug across the board, that would help a little bit. But you know, they have their own agendas, so I'm not sure what the answer is.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for the call. Back to a little more of the shortage discussion. I want to talk about the ingredients in many of these drugs. Is part of the reason for a shortage that maybe the plant is not being as grown, is not, there's a shortage of the plant that's been used for the compound for whatever the drug is that's coming out of, I don't know, Brazil or Kenya or whatever?
It depends on the drug product. You know, certainly some medications are derived from a natural source, and there has to be some mechanism for harvesting and purifying that natural source, whereas some of the other products in short supply are truly completely synthetic products that are synthesized in a laboratory. So those are two separate issues, but there are certainly some medications still today that are derived from a natural product, and if we can't either grow enough of that natural product or be able to have a safe, standardized supply from the however that product is naturally available, that can be a challenge.
Let's go to a couple emails, Amy. This from JJ. Please address non-conventional drugs that are available outside the USA, some of which seem to be very beneficial to users, but perhaps because they don't have as much of a monetary value to the industry, they're not available here. The, I don't know how you pronounce this, ricin, R-E-I-S-I-N, mushroom, for instance. What do tests indicate about that and perhaps some of those other drugs available outside the USA?
Sure. I'm not as familiar with that particular mushroom, but what I will say is that a big challenge in the United States is that if a product truly is from a natural source and is that way with and has pharmacological activity without further manipulation, it is going to be unlikely that an American drug company would be going through all of the regulatory aspects necessary to get that drug approved if it is something that isn't patentable. So if it, you know, you can't really patent a mushroom.
Right.
So kind of going back to the whole challenge of saying how is a product derived back to in the United States, we have a for-profit drug industry, so there's always going to be challenges with that. How difficult is it to mass produce it? So there have been many times when there have been things from natural sources that seemed very promising, but there was no way to scale that production, either of a very slow-growing plant or something like that. So there's a variety of challenges with natural products, but since in the United States, there's kind of this third category of products, which kind of ties us into our dietary supplement discussion. There's products that are regulated as drugs, and then there are products that are regulated as foods, and then there are these category of dietary supplements, which are highly unregulated. So in that situation, there's a lot of I think unease from the traditional medical community, and that we know that there's some manufacturers out there who maybe aren't as ethical or
sure.
have products that they make claims to which they don't have data to substantiate those claims. So we're hesitant to recommend products that don't have data to support their use. So on the other hand, I think we also have a fear from a regulatory standpoint if there is good data to support its use, but it isn't manufactured in a way that we trust, we're hesitant to recommend that as well. And I do think there's products that fall into that category.
So I'm hearing you say that we really need to pay some attention to this whole industry and perhaps have some kind of regulation.
Oh, absolutely. That when you look at what quote-unquote regulation is available through dietary supplements, the regulation is related to how that product should be made, and the promotion of those products are not regulated by the FDA at all. They're regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, just like any other product that would be marketed that is outside of the scope of healthcare. And so the challenge is if there's not really a lot of authority, next to no authority by the FDA to say that you're making unsubstantiated claims. You're trying to sell a product based on claims that you can't support with scientific evidence. So that's very different than a drug product, that the FDA has that authority, and manufacturers of drugs can't make claims about a product that they don't have data to support those claims.
Right. Another email that's come in, we are only a minute before we have to say goodbye. Karen in Madison, my fiancé needs to take a medication, Cromolyn sodium daily. Unfortunately, it's a medication that's only produced on a relatively small scale. If he didn't have insurance, it would cost $85 a day, way outside what we would be able to cover. If he does not take his medicine, his body rejects food and his intestines turn on themselves. If he were to choose not to take the medication, he would die. So,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. There are so many really heartbreaking stories involved in all of this, aren't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are.
Yeah.
And it's real. You know, it affects
right.
real lives, real people.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
challenging.
Thank you so much for being with us, Amy.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. And for taking on both of the issues as well, Professor Amy Peek, our guest this hour, Associate Professor of Pharmacy Practice in the College of Pharmacy Health Science at Butler University. Her expertise is on drug medical information and also on herbal products and dietary supplements. Thanks for your calls, everybody, and for your emails. We concentrated on what's going on with drug shortages now, and also why are middle school boys deciding to take supplements that may be harmful to them to make sure they have a body that looks muscular. Second hour of our program, please stay with us. It is our book club and the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, written in 1845. We'll have two guests with us, and I hope that you will join our conversation. If you've read the book or not, you can learn about it. All of that is coming up.